Welcome to your May 3rd Committee on Rules. We used to meet in the morning. That's why I'm functioning in morning time. As you see, the Secretary of State has come forward, and we're going to open a public hearing on a bill that he would like to testify on. Most of you can probably guess what it is. But I did want to inform folks in the audience that we are not going to do a work session on Senate Bill 564 today. I don't know that we will ever do a work session on it. If you're interested in that particular bill, please come see me. I think it's run into some constitutional problems. Anybody know what that means? That means I don't think there's enough votes on it. Okay, and since we don't have a quorum yet, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1046. And I would ask Ms. Harris to tell us a little bit about the bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1046 authorizes the Secretary of State to enter into agreements with a maximum of 6 counties to allow qualified electors with disabilities to vote by telephone in an election other than a primary, general, or statewide special election.
Great. Mr. Secretary, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, members of the committee.
And now we officially have a quorum. We're no longer in subcommittee.
Okay. For the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1046. Your committee administrator, Tiffany, just did a good job of describing it. It's a very simple bill. The Help America Vote Act places a deadline on states to allow all voters to vote privately and independently by January 1st, 2006, which is next January. Because there is no magic voting system that addresses all the needs of every type of disability, we must take a multifaceted approach in meeting the requirements that people with disabilities be able to vote privately and independently. Voting by telephone can be one part of our multifaceted approach to this problem. Telephone voting provides many people with disabilities with easier access to voting because they can vote from home using a machine which they're already familiar. In fact, at our accessible voting system vendor fair that was held in the Galleria in April, one of the telephone voting demonstrations was very well received and received a lot of support from those who came to check it out from the disability community. It's important to remember that telephone voting systems are new, and there are sure to be some kinks that need to be worked out. That's why this pilot program would start in local and low-interest elections. It's kind of like how we started vote by mail in the state, is in local and less interest, lower interest elections, got the kinks worked out, and then moved to the primary and the general. So starting small and local allows us to figure out what works and what doesn't work so that we can learn from experience and over time create the best telephone voting system possible. Because telephone voting can be an important part of a multifaceted approach to allowing people with disabilities to vote and allowing them to vote privately and independently, I urge your support for this pilot program contained in Senate Bill 1046.
Thank you. Mr. Lindback, do you have anything?
Not at this time.
Questions from the committee. Mr. Secretary, could you talk a little bit about how we make sure that there's no fraud that takes place?
In terms of telephone voting, mm-hmm. I would love my elections director to address
okay.
that question.
All right.
Madam Chairman, I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. It depends on the kind of system that you use, and again, these systems are in the development stages and being tested. They have different means of doing that. One of the ways is to issue a voter who's participating a PIN number that's exclusive to them and them only. And they first enter their PIN number and then they're allowed to vote. But one of the ideas behind a pilot of this kind is to test out those various security issues and a variety of other issues that will come up with regards to a new voting system of this kind.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 1046. I'm assuming Senator Ringo's on the way, but I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 849. Mr. Holt, would you please come forward?
I might want to explain the work that I'm doing.
And for folks in the audience, don't worry. Stay tuned. We will come back to Senate Bill 1046.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hi, Mr. Holt. We've got three amendments in front of them. I understand the first two are yours. Is that correct?
Yes. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. The Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments are our amendments. They correct some technical issues in the bill. And then the Dash 3s, as I understand, are from the physician assistants, and we've reviewed them, and we're okay with those.
Okay, thank you. Is somebody here from the Oregon Medical Association? Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. Andy Easton, Oregon Medical Association.
Good to see you. Ms. Easton, I was just curious whether the Oregon Medical Association has any objection to the Dash 3 amendments.
The Oregon Medical Association is okay with the Dash 3 amendment.
Okay, and it's my understanding OMA is okay with both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate you,
thank you.
Coming forward. We're in work session on Senate Bill 849. Any questions, concerns about the amendments?
The three.
The chair is going to move the Dash 1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move the Dash 2 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move the Dash 3. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 849 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Devlin will carry the bill. Thank you. Close the work session. We're going to open back a work session on Senate Bill 1046. I assume there's a list of folks who are interested in testifying. There's a huge list. Okay, I'm going to take them in no particular order except other than they were listed. So Mr. Rob Cook, Ms. Jean Marie Moore, and Mr. Ken River Nider. Come on up. That's fine. Can I have you speak a little louder, please, so we can get your testimony for the record? That's great.
There's no mic? Okay.
There is. It's just at about waist level.
Okay.
You got it. There you go.
Okay. Maybe that works a little bit better.
That's perfect.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Rob Cook, Robert G. Cook for the record. I live in Springfield, and I have small businesses. I'm also a disabilities commissioner. I'm here with Lane Independent Living Alliance, and independent living is pretty synonymous with all facets of independence as any human being in the civil rights grant. One of those is voting, and to vote for me, it means quite a bit. And I think even though in my household where we have a low vision person and myself a blind person, we still need a reader, even though we really favor the ballot by mail. Pilot projects such as telephone voting, which could lead to full access for us. People with visual impairments, there's quite a few disabilities that are unknown or not thought of or invisible, as they call it, me being totally blind at times and often looked at as though I can see what's going on. And so when I'm handed things and I can't read them, one of the easiest accesses is in electronics, and I'm really happy to say that when I went to the voter fair, I really liked the voting phone systems. One in particular I liked, but that's up to the HAVA committee and the disability subcommittee to really look into that. Not being aware of the technical aspects, I do know that as I support this 1046 bill, I think it's important to note that it'd be no cost on the state because funds are already designated by the Help America Vote Act federal funds. And I just think at this point it's really important to note in our fiscal times, in the long term, with the pilot project, as Secretary Bradbury stated, that can start the ball rolling maybe to a future time, such as in England, where there's voting for a lot of people. A great majority can vote by computer. In England, they vote by phone, and it's fully secure. And basically, I would just like to lend my support as a person with a disability and speaking as a commissioner for the Oregon Disabilities Commission. Close to a third of this state have some sort of a significant disability. And I think those people, in the smaller percentage like me, that can't utilize the print, would really enjoy, possibly even, you know, more than desire, the access to vote by phone. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cook, and you're welcome to either hang out in front or head back to your seat, is whatever you prefer. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and other committee members. My name is Jean Marie Moore, and I live in Eugene. And I am here today to ask you to support Senate Bill 1046. There are a lot of questions about telephone voting and about whether it will work or not. I know in England it is being used successfully, and I would like you to consider doing everything in your power to help this pass out of the Senate and help people in the House understand the advantages, and hopefully it would pass in the House. I've never had a secret ballot in my life, and it would mean a great deal to me to have this telephone voting pilot project, because I'm a phone techie. I can use the phone to do many, many things, and can also help other people learn to use the phone to do lots of things. And many blind people are very familiar with the telephone. We get lots and lots of things done with it. And so in that sense, it would be a familiar technology. There are lots of different questions, and I believe that those questions could only be resolved by a pilot project such as this one. So I would really appreciate that, and I have my testimony here.
Great.
For you.
Thank you. I'll have committee staff come get a copy of it. Thank you, Ms. Moore. Mr. Rivernider, did I get that last name right?
Perfect.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name's Ken Rivenider of Eugene. It was the intent of the legislature to allow independent voting in the privacy of one's home by all of the voters in the state when they enacted voting by mail. So we should follow that to its logical conclusion and approve the trial of phone voting for the disabled. To make the right to exercise one's vote privately and conveniently all-inclusive. Thank you.
Thank you. Holy smokes, you've been taking lessons about how to testify in front of the legislature. Ms. Otten, Mr. Oregon, and Mr. Goebel. We tried to see if we could find a roving mic to make it a little easier, but we haven't been able to find one, so...
Okay. Madam Chairman, or Chairperson, Chairman Brown, members of the committee. My name is Mary Otten, and I'm from Eugene. And I am also here to urge you to support Bill 1046 and pass it out onto the Senate floor and help it get through the Senate and through the House eventually. I've been blind all my life. I've been voting for decades, and I have yet to be able to vote a truly secret ballot. I appreciate the vote by mail. However, that still requires the use of a reader. One of the really great things about vote by phone, were you to allow this pilot project, would be the chance for people who don't have access to transportation and who might not be able to get to a polling place to access an accessible voting machine in such a polling place, to be able to vote conveniently, easily, privately, completely independently from their home. Transportation is a huge problem for many people with disabilities, especially the visually impaired, but others as well. And it's especially important to remember that when considering this bill, because it really will allow those of us who don't have easy access to transportation to do for the first time in our lives what most Americans take for granted, that is to say, vote a truly secret ballot. And I'm looking forward to the day when I get to do that, and I simply urge you all to vote in favor of this bill and help it pass. And I'm hoping that my county is one that's going to be involved in the pilot project. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And since your county's brought most of the witnesses, I suspect it'll be first on the radar screen. Mr. Oregon, good to see you. Welcome.
Good to see you. Yeah. Good morning. Afternoon. I made your mistake. My name is Eugene Oregon, and I am from Eugene. No laughter, please.
Wait. No.
It's true. That's fantastic. I got here in a car. Anyway, I am with...
Were you actually born in Eugene?
No.
Okay.
My wife is from Eugene. We met in the Midwest, and she brought me home. She said, "You've got to live there." I am here today as the board president for the Independent Living Alliance in Eugene. We are the ones who actually brought this bill or pushed this bill forward. I think we're the requester on record. And I think I have written testimony I've supplied. I just wanted to augment that with a couple of comments. I was, for over 10 years, the executive director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. During that time, vote by mail was an issue, and our commission supported that concept because we fully understood that for many people with disabilities, it was a benefit. For those of us who use wheelchairs and have other mobility impairments, vote by mail made a great deal of sense. However, two significant groups of people with disabilities were left behind on the access route that we took. And those are people with visual impairments or people who are blind. And those whose disabilities manifest themselves in lack of manual dexterity and are unable to physically mark a ballot. I find myself, ironically, in both categories. I'm legally blind and have been for many years, but I have some vision, obviously, but still cannot read the ballot. I now have multiple sclerosis, and I am unable to mark a ballot physically. Vote by phone would make a great deal of sense for me. My wife, ironically, likes to tell people that when we got married, she got two votes. But be that as it may, I think I still can be return home, even if this bill passes. And I certainly hope it does. And I encourage your support of the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Goble?
I didn't take questions.
We're going to get someone from behind to help you with your mic, but I think we can hear you.
There you go.
Chair Brown, my name is Springfield, Oregon. My name is Frederick Goble. I'm a resident of Springfield, Oregon. And I would just like to echo what those preceding me have expressed here today. And I urge you to give us the opportunity to vote with security and confidence. And that's it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for coming to see us today. Be with us today. I'm going to ask the last panel to come up, and while I'm going to do that, I'm going to call a woman from Washington, D.C., who's on a study in England. Her name is Angela Katsikas. And in the meanwhile, I'd ask for Mary Dole, Cora Jones, and Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson to come forward. You're welcome. Thank you. Hi, this is State Senator Kate Brown calling from Portland, Oregon. I'm looking for Ms. Angela Katsikas.
Katsakis,
okay.
Thank you.
That's me. Hi. Cora?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is Senator Brown. How are you?
Very well. How are you, Senator?
Good. You are actually on a conference phone on a dais with several other senators and a crowded room full of folks, and so your testimony is going all over the Capitol today. I'd ask you to identify your name for the record.
Of course. My name is Angela Katsakis.
And Ms. Katsakis, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I work with the American Association of People with Disabilities, and my job title is a Disability Vote Project Coordinator. I obviously do much more than that, and my part of my responsibility is to focus on HAVA implementation, that is Help America Vote Act, for people with disabilities, which ends up benefiting everyone, not just the disability community.
We've heard a little bit about this afternoon about England's system, which allows folks to testify by telephone. Could you tell us a little bit about what you've discovered from your studies?
Well, first of all, let me say that whenever I spoke with Tiffany today, the opportunity to testify is a great honor and a surprise, a pleasant surprise. And the best that I can do is give you a brief summary of what the United Kingdom has been doing.
That would be great.
And I also have a hearty recommendation that it would be a very smart thing to spend the time to talk with the members of the UK community that have been responsible for implementing this. I've invested a lot of time because it has definite positive implications for people with disabilities or people who do not speak English fluently in terms of being able to vote with privacy, dignity, and secrecy, which is something that's important for everyone. My 3 points in the testimony, and I'm very happy to answer any and all questions that you might have, is to talk in a broad basis about the voting trials that they did in the United Kingdom in May of 2003. And in the United Kingdom, they hold their elections in May. and to go over a brief technical summary, and then to give you the response of how people felt about the system. In the United Kingdom, they are investing quite a bit of money in upgrading all of government, part of which is voting. And their voting turnout is much higher than what we typically see in the United States. And they saw a slip in the voting turnout from 75% to about 59%, and that became a cause for concern. So they started looking at different ways to increase voter participation by offering different systems. They launched phone voting trials in 17 cities throughout the United Kingdom. That was out of 59 trials, including Birmingham, which is the UK's second largest city. Excuse me, you have to forgive me, I'm a little bit under the weather today. So they had five different methods of voting that they were examining. And just to give you a brief overview, it was voting by internet, voting by telephone, voting by text messaging on your cell phone, voting by post, by mail.
If I can interrupt, I think our experience with voting by text messaging has only been through American Idol.
Well, yes, and text messaging and telephones in Europe are far in advance of what we have in the United States. And the final option was, again, to vote via TV. Again, the digital televisions in the UK are far in advance of the United States. And they had 59 jurisdictions, all of which had an individual assortment. And considering what's going on with American Idol, it definitely doesn't bode that well for cell phone voting, does it?
I haven't seen the recent versions.
Well, I won't go into it. It's spicy. what they did do is they asked different election officials to apply for the different phone trials, which the UK referred to as pilots or channels. And then each individual phone trial is regarded as a pilot. And so you have 59 cities, and they had 160,000 people voting through each of these individual methods. And the second most popular choice for voting was the telephone voting. And the way it worked in the UK was, and getting into some of the more technical aspects, people had the opportunity to dial in from home. They dialed in an 800 number, and they got an interactive voice response system. Kind of like whenever you call into an automated phone server and they say press 1 for English and 2 for Spanish. And they utilized a lot of different vendors to provide the framework and the interface for each of these phone voting trials. They were interested in seeing how each vendor came up with the engineering to make it work and to look at the different approaches so that then whenever the trial was finished, they could evaluate which method seemed to be the best interface to make it go. Pardon me. And in the process of the voting, the voter had a PIN number that was assigned, and then each candidate was assigned an individual number, and they were able to match up the two. Similar to the two-key system that you see in movies this is probably a very bad example, but you had a dual PIN code that came in two separate pieces of mail, which the voter was able to use to establish who they were in the system so that there wouldn't be anyone that would vote twice.
So this would be the way you would avoid fraud, at least under this particular system.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And the technical report, which was attached to the email that I sent, goes through each individual type of voting. And again, I'm repeating something and streamlining a lot of it, and strongly encourage you to talk to the British about how they crafted the system and made it work so well. they went to great pains to make sure that a voter could only vote once, number one, and number two, if they ran into a problem in the system, because it's a new system and the people didn't know how to use it very well, they provided a call-in number for users to call, and in the call-in center they would reset the system so that the voter could then place their vote. And they weren't ticked off or checked off on the voting roll until after the vote was recorded properly in the system. And it worked extremely well because I asked questions about error rates, and they did what we would call logic and accuracy testing multiple times through the system prior to opening it up on election day. And in terms of decrypting the data, because each time the system, the information went through the system, it was encrypted multiple layers, again, to provide security. And then there was a very specific decryption step, which was performed by what would be the equivalent of the head of the Board of Elections, in order to safeguard the system, ensure the safe download, and turn it over to a tabulation center where all of the votes could be tabulated for each individual election. I have to say that in terms of usage with phone voting, the numbers were very, very high for user preference. Mm. It provided an access for people with disabilities. It provided an option for people that, you know, didn't want to do postal or wanted to do something experimental with their voting. And it was the second highest choice of the voter to respond with their civic participation by using the telephone. So I can tell you that in the course of reading the data that I have, I found myself drawn in and enveloped by how elegantly they pulled all of the various systems together and how responsive they were to the security issue.
Thank you. I have a question from Senator Shields.
Yes.
Yes, thank you for all the information you've shared today. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happened since this test in 2003? What's the upshot? What's the proposals for moving forward? Are they going to make this thing universal after a while? What are they thinking about?
Senator, that's such a great question. Yes, they are. And they have a major parliamentary election occurring on May 5th, and then they're going to be running the trial on a broader basis in May 2006 to refine what they've done so far and to make it a permanent part of providing an option for voting. So it's definitely growing. Pardon me.
Follow-up, Senator Shields.
So do people get to choose what form they want to vote in? I mean, going to the polls or doing it by phone or...
Absolutely.
Is that the way they do it?
Absolutely. You're looking at... They provided a PC to vote on the Internet right in the polling place. They provided a telephone for people to vote right in the polling place. They provided postal voting for some people that prefer the tried and true. There were so many different options, and it depended upon each local jurisdiction which options were available for the voters to use. And it was up to the director of the Board of Elections to determine what would be best based on the demographic in their community. And the objective here is to provide, they recognize that with so many people having different disabilities, that making it a choice or a menu of the best way to vote was a very smart option for their population. And it's been very successful. I'd also like to take this opportunity to mention Professor Ted Selker from MIT. He has extensive experience on working on interfaces for computers and how people with disabilities respond to using automated services in terms of developing telephone voting. And I understand Oregon is quite the leader in the country that you have excellent election officials in the state. He would be an outstanding resource.
Who paid her to say that?
Sorry?
Scoring lots of brownie points here.
Well, I actually went to the Secretary of State's website, and I looked up and I saw the turnout, and my jaw just bounced off the pavement. I mean, over 80% is marvelous.
Thank you. We're very pleased. Of course, we think it could be better, and we would hope that if we could move forward on this proposal, we could have even better turnout. Ms. Katsakis, you on your email had a quote that I really enjoyed. Did you want to share it with the committee and our folks in the audience?
Oh, yes, of course. Justin Dart was a leader in the disability community, and he often said, "Vote as if your life depended on it, because it does."
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your time, and we'll probably be in touch as we kind of iron out some of the wrinkles here. And we, of course, would love to have you lead a field trip on the Oregon Senate Rules Committee to the UK to study their balloting system.
Well, actually, that might be a possibility. Not that AAPC could afford to do anything like that, but they did mention that they would be having international observers at their next trial. Senator, would you like me to send an email to Tiffany with the names of the people that I've had conference calls with for contact?
That would be helpful. Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you for your time.
You're
appreciate
more
you welcome. Staying after work hours.
Have a great evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just a comment. This really serves to remind us, you know, we're used to being so proud of ourselves,
right,
being the only ones who vote by mail, and all of a sudden we look like we're in horse and buggy age.
It's really true. Okay, the three of you. I'm sorry, I didn't think it would take so long, but why doesn't someone go ahead and get started, and we'll hear from you as well.
My name is Mary Dole. I'm from Eugene, Oregon, and I am honored to be able to speak in support of this bill. I've been a resident of Oregon since 1992, and I love the vote-by-mail system because it does allow me to at least vote in my home. But the problem, of course, is that I have to have somebody read me the ballots and punch the ballots before they, and then draw the arrows now. So it would be wonderful to be able to do it all myself, and I'm sure this is true for any of us who are unable to mark a ballot. So I urge you to get this bill into the Senate, and hopefully we can pass it. And I didn't know about UK until today. I think it's wonderful. And so it seems like it does work. So I'm very glad that it does. And thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Good afternoon. My name is Cora Jones. I'm from Eugene, Oregon, and I've always voted, but sometimes I don't know whether my vote counted with my signature. So that I would love to see the vote by phone take place in the near future. And not only for me, but for other people who are blind or visually impaired and may have other disabilities with it, but the signature really does count. And if we miss one vote, or we count on a reader to help us vote, and they make a mistake, you know, so that one vote does count. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. I appreciate you bringing up the fact that one vote does count. What I share with a number of folks that I talk to on a regular basis is that I actually won my first race by 7 votes out of 7,000. So I truly understand that one vote does make a difference. Ms. Newingham, I know, and Mr. Lindbacker in the audience, be curious how we're going to deal with telephone votes in the future in terms of a recount. So I'll just put that question out there and let you two think about it. And Senator Shields has a question.
Yes, I have a question for you, but first I have to point out that even the transcription machine over on the wall didn't get it right. They thought you won by 7,000 votes. That's what went up on there. Nobody believes you really won by 7,000. Believe me, I was there. I've called landslide Kate ever since. My question to you is about the signature. How do you deal with the signature after you've voted your ballot, does somebody put your hand online and you scribble something there? Does that change over time, your signature, that is? How do you deal with the signature issue?
Well,
whoever.
One of the things that working at Lane Independent Living Alliance, a lot of people came and asked about that, and we have they have the ballot, and then they have the signature card, and they follow that signature card and to compare it with the ballot, and if they see that, hey, that signature doesn't match, so we can't count that vote. So those of us who are blind or visually impaired, some use like a signature guide or any type of reference card to use for to guide you when they're signing, and we just hope that it, however we signed it, counts. And you know,
they've changed it to make it better. I hear from the audience.
Gwyneth, do you want to respond?
There are different. Excuse me. I'm Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson. Excuse me. I'm also from Eugene, Oregon. We dragged every blink off the street we could find to come here today. Hi, Kate. As far as signature guides are concerned, what it looks like basically is a little piece of plastic about 2x3, perhaps, and it has a rectangle cut out in it that you would place over the line. They have them specifically arranged for checks so that you can have, you know where the spaces are, but not everybody uses them. Another way is to, what I do is I just lay my hand down a quarter of an inch above the line, and then I write my signature under my hand so that it parallels the line. There's different ways that people have figured out to do it. One of the biggest problems is for people who are losing their vision, and they often don't know it, and that's kind of odd to contemplate, but the fact is that our brains fill in the blanks, and you don't know how much vision you really don't have until you fall into a manhole, which I did once, or some other devastating thing like riding your bike down the steps instead of the ramp. And a lot of people continue to drive, unfortunately, and to try to read print. My husband's over 50, and as many, many other aging baby boomers, he is finding that he's having a lot of trouble reading regular-sized print and has to scramble for his glasses, and I sure feel sorry for the guy. I remember all that. Oh yes, there's also something else called a signature stamp for people who never learned how to write, or for people who want to have their signature embossed in some form that looks the same every time. I think this vote by phone is such a great idea. Voting by mail is one big step in the right direction. I don't have to argue with election clerks anymore about where exactly that line is to sign my name before I can ballot at the elections polling place. Excuse me. And I have a loving, trusting husband who I believe can and will sign, or excuse me, punch in the right place. But that's not always the case. There are examples that we have in our community of people who not only couldn't get into the into the election office before it became accessible, but when they asked their care provider to assist them, she was told that she needed to vote her party line, and she wasn't allowed to vote the way she wanted to. So it's really an issue of trust that that makes the confidentiality issue such an issue. I wanted to say that it's not just aging baby boomers, but according to Oregon Health Sciences University Center for Disease Control, they did a survey a couple of years ago that asked Oregonians, do you consider yourself having one or more significant disabilities? And 30% average across the state said yes. 30% of the population of Oregon has some significant disability. And that is probably going to continue to increase as the baby boomers age and retire. So there's a lot of reason for for accessible voting. And as Mary Dole said earlier, or Mary Otten, excuse me, that transportation is a big issue. Not everybody is in an area where they can get paratransit or a bus or can talk somebody into taking them somewhere. And again, that's an issue of independence. There's one other statistic that I want you to know, excuse me, and it was developed by the American Association of People with Disabilities, who you just spoke with on the phone, and that is that between 59% and 79% of blind voters don't vote in the state of Oregon. And this is the reason, lack of access. So this telephone voting system is a wonderful opportunity for people who don't have computers, and lots of blind people don't, and lots of people who have hand dexterity problems don't. And being able to use a telephone, especially one that is voice recognition, which is one of the systems that we experimented with at the vendor fair, that's one that could minimize use of hands. But the last piece that I wanted to say is that besides accessibility, independence, privacy, and all that, I agree with the committee that security is just paramount. And I believe that there is a way that we can create a paper ballot, one for the elections office and one to be mailed back to the voter. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on this bill? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1046. We're going to just let it ruminate. I'm going to ruminate on it for a couple of days, and we'll probably bring it back after I talk to committee members. We actually don't have enough members here today to move forward on it. As you can see, we're a little short-handed. But I anticipate we will move the bill in relative short order. So thank you all for coming today. We appreciate your participation. And obviously, we'll see if we can get Lane County on the radar screen to be one of the pilot projects if we can get the bill through. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1048. Ms. Harris, would you tell us a little about the bill? Is Representative Dingfelter coming? Not this year.
That was the plan.
Okay. We're hoping Representative Dingfelter is listening and hears us opening the hearing. And in the meanwhile, I'd invite Mr. Repine and Ms. Jones to come forward. And Ms. Whitney Weiser, you are cross off. You want to... Come on up.
I'd love to tell you about the bill.
Okay.
I can't find you.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1048 establishes a council for the purpose of eradicating homelessness in Oregon and coordinating statewide efforts to eradicate homelessness.
I don't want to move the bill. Do you want to move 1046? Yeah. Are you ready? Are we ready to move 1046? You know what? I think I want to talk.
You're in center.
Hi. Welcome.
Senator Brown, committee members, I will go ahead and start the presentation if you're ready for it.
We're ready. Go ahead.
Thank you. We had some handouts. I would assume that you got, there's a, should be a handout that has kind of a series of boxes on both the front and the back side. Kind of a configuration of what is currently in place under the law and what we're proposing to do. Thank you. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And with me, I have Patty Whitney Wise and Jody Jones. Patty Whitney Wise is the staff person who works on the Hunger Task Force, and so I'm going to try to weave this story together for you as quickly as I can. We're here we're happy to be with you this afternoon to talk about Senate Bill 1048. We think in today's environment this is an extremely important piece of legislation that you are considering today. Senate Bill 1048 is framed after a current statute in Oregon law that was an effort to bring all state agencies and private and nonprofit partners together to address the issues around hunger in the state of Oregon. And since 1993, when that statute was passed, that group has been meeting on a regular basis, at least since 1998, since I came on board with the agency, and have done some amazing things on behalf of Oregonians dealing with the issues of hunger, and I'm sure Patty will talk a little bit more about that later. What you're seeing in Senate Bill 1048 is really a a replication of that process that has been very successful around hunger. Many of you know or are aware, and it's not too many times, you can't pick up a newspaper or see a news story that's talking about the issues of homelessness, both in the state of Oregon and nationally. The idea of this bill is to create this parallel process where many of the players who are on the hunger task force can also join in some of the discussion around homelessness issues. And at the same time, we are bringing new people to the table who should be at the table with us when we are talking about homelessness and those issues around it. So it really is an expansion of an existing very successful program, inviting more state agencies together so we can talk on one common line and come up with common decisions and discussions on the topics. Again, what you'll get with this, I believe, as in the same way we've had the discussion around hunger issues, is you'll get a very succinct process of planning for the issues of homelessness for the state of Oregon. You will help the state and my agency work on and continue developing their 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness. And you will have a process that will allow recommendations and proposals to be previewed and make recommendations both to the governor and to this legislative assembly. Again, the scope of the membership currently is dealing with hunger. The intent of this bill is to add the other piece on that will deal with issues around homelessness and create a parallel part of a homeless advisory council. I had the pleasure of calling all the agencies who were to be assumed to be joining into this effort when this bill passes, to let them know that they are being drafted and requested to be at the table with us to talk about homelessness issues. They are excited to be there with us. I told them there is a cost to be at the table with us, and the cost currently, as we have been imposing the cost, each agency that participates pays $8,000 annually to help support the task force, both the hunger task force and now the homeless task force. Finally, there are some minor modifications in the bill dealing with issues around the hunger task force that we found that were somewhat cumbersome. We've changed the definition of participating agencies so we don't tie it to the forever changing names of agencies and the subcomponents of those agencies. So we talk about agencies that are related to seniors, let's say, who have interest in both hunger and homelessness, as opposed to calling it the Agency on Senior People with Disabilities, because 2 years from now it could be called something else. So, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, and committee members, that's a brief overview. Again, you were given a quick cheat sheet on what the constitute of the current hunger task force is and what the new assumed configuration and responsibilities of the hunger / homeless interagency group would be working on if this bill is approved. Not answer any questions for you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Repine. I'm going to actually close the public hearing on this Senate bill. No offense, I hope, taken. Now that we have a quorum, we have a number of folks here from Lane County, and I wanted to be able to move forward on Senate Bill 1046 now that we have a quorum. We're in work session on Senate Bill 1046. Senator Shields.
Well, I'd certainly like to move Senate Bill 1046 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields has moved Senate Bill 1046 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, passes. And I'm sure we'll find a carrier. No, Mr. Repine, that was not for you. As much as we love you. Okay. You're welcome. We appreciate you all coming. All right. Back in public hearing on Senate Bill 1048, the chair apologizes. I need to go to a meeting that was previously scheduled before we change our proceedings. And I know there are a number of executive appointments. You will be heard today. So,
If you can get a call, if you can, once you're done with the bill, call me and I'll come back down.
Okay.
There you go.
Let's continue. We'll just ignore them and continue with your testimony, okay?
Okay, I guess I will.
Chair Shields at this point and members of the committee. I am Jody Jones, the Assistant Manager of the Community Services Section for Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. And prior to that position, I served as the Homeless Coordinator for the department for 11 years. I'm here to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 1048, which will improve the coordination of planning and services for addressing hunger and homelessness throughout the state. In Oregon, there has been a steady increase in homelessness over the last 10 years. Whether you attribute that increase to an increase in unemployment, an increase in housing costs, a decline in the economy, better data collection, or whatever reason, the fact still remains that on any given night in the state of Oregon, we have more than 8,500 people who are homeless. Of those, 35% of them are children. Despite the many efforts by the state agencies to individually address homelessness, Oregon has fallen far short of the benchmarks that we have set for Oregon. Agencies have the best intentions in mind when they make decisions with regards to addressing homelessness, but unfortunately, they cannot begin to anticipate all of the ripple effects that occur by those decisions. For example, a decision by a state agency often impacts the demand on resources and the service delivery from another state agency or community partner. In Oregon, there's multiple agencies who have different programs that address various aspects of homelessness. What we currently are lacking is a means to coordinate each of these different efforts into a collaborative, streamlined plan to address and eventually prevent homelessness. Senate Bill 1048 creates the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council that will coordinate a comprehensive attack on homelessness throughout the state. This statewide coordination will maximize agency resources and efforts, which will in turn lead to the stabilization of individuals and families in Oregon. I'd like to briefly outline the Dash 1 amendments that were added. They add the Department of Justice to the list of new members to the Interagency Council as they provide shelter services for victims of domestic violence that have an important role in preventing homelessness. It clarifies the responsibility of the Interagency Coordinating Council with respect to state agencies, allowing them to implement their own reasonable improvements as they do on other state issues. And last, it eliminates the increased representation by the Community Action Directors of Oregon on the Hunger Relief Task Force. With this amendment, the makeup of the Hunger Relief Task Force will not be affected by this legislation. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, adding a Department of Justice, you said, is important because of the... Say that again.
The members from the Department of Justice provide the shelter services for domestic violence, the survivors who are in the shelters, and that is an intricate number of folks that are homeless.
And what do you expect this to be in the way of a financial burden on the Department of Justice? What time or time commitment will this require?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, currently the Interagency Council, Coordinating Council on Hunger, I think statutorily we're charged to meet at least quarterly. We generally have been meeting on a monthly basis, and sometimes we go to every other month. So that activity would be continued. We would assume that this at the current level that we're meeting on a monthly or possibly every other month. We'll try to make sure agendas and topics are out in time for people to review them, so it's a meaningful discussion when we do have a meeting.
Okay. And just follow up, Mr. Chairman. Sure. And you probably said this, and I'm sorry if I missed it. Does this bill have a fiscal?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, from what I understand, the legislative fiscal office was not able to get a response back for this meeting. The bill, as it's structured, doesn't. The current funding process is a kind of a agreed upon or through administrative rules, $8,000 to each agency who participates on an annual basis. So we pool our money together to get the necessary resources to fund the task force.
And is it contemplated, for example, that DOJ would be responsible for coming up with $8,000 worth of a person to pay for their role in the task force?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, in my discussions with the individual at the Justice Department, without identifying where the resources were coming from, we have tried to work with them to figure out other sources within their budgeting process where they might be able to tap in either to federal dollars or other funds that might be able to be used for the sources, but haven't found anybody who said that they wouldn't support the $8,000 annual cost.
The idea is that they have the resources. They'll absorb it. They'll find it somewhere.
That's the assumption, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I might contribute to the conversation because I've been part of the Hunger Relief Task Force for years, and the agencies are fairly familiar with the same contribution that they've made to the Hunger Relief Task Force. Sure. And one of the things relative to time and time commitment in a task force like this is that they're spending the time already wrestling with issues of hunger on the one hand, homelessness on another hand. This gives them a venue to compare thoughts and ideas and strategies in a broader agenda, and probably could end up saving them time, if anything. Just something to think about.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
I'm going to let you all step back.
You're going to let me say a word?
Well, I'd be in trouble if I didn't.
You would.
Kind of a Hunger Relief Task Force hold forth for a little bit.
Very briefly, I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and we are in support of this measure. We feel that this creates a sister model to the Hunger Relief Task Force, and that homelessness has become more and more common among people who are experiencing food insecurity and hunger. So the two are linked. In our Act End Hunger that I made copies available to you, we briefly touch on the need for affordable housing, and there's a clear need to go beyond that in addressing the issues of homelessness in a more comprehensive way. This would help do that, and we really look forward to working with Housing and Community Services to help incubate the new group, help them follow the track that we've been on to a certain extent in order to build their agenda and build those collaborative efforts with state agencies. We've seen some phenomenal success with the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger. The work around food stamp outreach is just one very good example where, combined together with all of our efforts, we've increased participation by over 70% in the state in the last 4 years, bringing in millions and millions of new federal resources and finally bringing our hunger rate down for the first time in many years. Thank you very much.
I guess I have a question for all of you, just real quick. Bob, as we were listening to the testimony about the Department of Justice coming in, I think of, okay, that's kind of a new venue for me to think about. Over here in the Hunger Relief Task Force, didn't have to think too much about that, but now over on the homeless kind of task force, yeah, that's an issue. Are there parallel issues like that? I think of some of the causes of homelessness and wonder if there are other agencies that would join you that you haven't thought about maybe yet because of some of the causes of homelessness that are certainly similar to, but maybe there's some different ones from the hunger end of things.
Mr. Chairman, to your question.
Yeah. What can I say? Don't blame me for being the only one left.
I think we've done a pretty good job with the help of Patty to try to figure out who are those logical members that should be part of this. So you actually see Department of Transportation now is involved in the homeless piece only because there is not a direct relationship to homelessness per se with transportation issues, but a hurdle for successful people to move away from long-term homelessness and to be stable many times is the transportation piece. And so we have identified agencies in some cases you would may not have made the original tie to homelessness. And so I think from our initial feel right now, we have done an adequate job identifying to get the process started. If we found that there were natural partners that we had not invited, I think there are some there's some leeway on appointing in the seating of the people at large type members if we can bring them on. So that's even in the hunger, I can tell you in the hunger activities where we found other agencies who were not by statute identified, we invited them and they were very happy to be there and participate with us. Now they didn't pay, but they did participate with us. So we've been trying to pick them up as they've become senior members and wanted to be part of that program.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I was just checking to see how you're doing.
Thanks a lot.
He's ready to move the bill.
Thank you. We would if we had a quorum.
Actually, we've got three more witnesses.
We'll let them come up while we look for our third, our missing, our member missing in action. Probably left because he knew I wasn't here watching him.
Yeah.
Ms. Lassiter, Ms. Van El, I know your last name, Elverdink, and Ms. Skira. Skira? Did I get it? Was I close?
S-K-R-Y, Skria?
Skria.
Okay, just like it's spelled.
Sort of.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and Senator Shields. My name is Jean Lassiter, and I live and work here in Salem, and I'm here representing the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. And I am here also to advocate for Senate Bill 1048. As you may know, the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition has been working for about a year and a half, reporting to an interim committee and also to the House Health and Human Services Committee on the status of runaway and homeless youth in the state of Oregon. And we have a companion piece of legislation, House Bill 2202, which we are hopeful to see passed and may well come your way. And really what I'd like to bring to this discussion is that homelessness is a progressive condition. And we have estimated that in our kind of cursory look at the status of young people in this state with regard to homelessness and runaway, is that there's upwards of 20,000 of them that have experienced a runaway or a homeless condition in the state of Oregon in a given year. And what we know about young people is that if we don't intercede and we don't offer them some kind of a change in their circumstances when they first experience running away as a coping behavior, what happens is they may well continue on to running away more and more, and they may well end up on the streets, and they may well end up as a homeless adult. So, in summary, Senate Bill 1048 really is what I regard as an effort to elevate the status of the condition of homelessness, of being homeless, to appropriate levels. And I believe it also serves to provide a comprehensive approach to addressing the issue of homelessness, and by combining it with the issue of hunger, we really are kind of taking a dual approach to solving the problem. So we would encourage you to vote positively on this bill.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Wendy Van Alberdeen, and I'm the Executive Director of CATO, Community Action Directors of Oregon. I'm giving you written testimony. I'm not going to read it all. I'm just going to pull a few highlights out of it. First of all, CATO urges your support of Senate Bill 1048 as amended. Community Action is a national network of organizations working to eradicate the causes and conditions of poverty. Started as a program under President Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty, Community Action agencies have been fighting poverty in Oregon communities for nearly 40 years. Although each Community Action board, each agency has its own board, develops the priorities for the CAA, they all understand the need for coordinated efforts on a variety of issues to move families and individuals out of crisis and into stable conditions. It is because of this intimate understanding of the interconnectedness of the issues that I am here today to support Senate Bill 1048. CATO supports the creation of the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council, as well as expanding the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger. Understanding that hunger and homelessness go hand in hand is the beginning of expanding the discussion on addressing poverty in Oregon. The creation of the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council is a much-needed part of the puzzle to address poverty. Expanding the ICCH to include homelessness expands the discussion beyond hunger issues to include more of the root causes of poverty. We welcome this expanded discussion with more partners to develop better solutions. If you want to look at the third page of my testimony, it's some information that looks at 40 years ago, how people moved out of poverty, and why those no longer work today. Such things as one full-time job would move a family out of poverty. Today it takes two full-time minimum wage jobs to move a family out of poverty. So it's a whole list of things there. Have you ever heard a child say that when he or she grows up, they want to be homeless and hungry? This legislation is a step toward finding a cure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Vicki Scria, and I'm the Housing Development Coordinator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to also support Senate Bill 1048. One of the things I've been able to do in the past year and a half or so is co-chair the Oregon Homeless Policy Team with Jody Jones from the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, and we were able to participate in a federal homeless policy academy on ending chronic homelessness, and I think it brought a lot of us together across state boundaries to address homelessness issues, and really found a lot of value in that. As a person who works in the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Disorders, we know that it's about 6 to 8% of the people we serve who enroll in services for mental health or addiction treatment are homeless at the time of enrollment, and so it is a big issue for us, and I've worked on trying to increase affordable housing opportunities for people with mental health and addiction disorders, and I know there's just a real huge amount of work to be done in that area.
Thank you. Question, Senator Shields?
Not so much a question, but just a comment. And I appreciate the testimony that was just given, because this addiction area and its relationship to homelessness is a major issue that the task force will have to address, and to have people that know and understand that dimension of it. And the mental illness piece as well. I don't know if you've done it in your districts, but I've been watching the mentally ill homeless and the addicted homeless in my district and in inner city Portland as well.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. That we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1048 unless anyone else in the audience is wishing to testify. Move into work session on Senate Bill 1048. Senator Shields, we have dash one amendments.
Yes.
You want to walk us through the amendments? Somebody
they walked us through, Senator.
Okay.
Brown.
All right. So you feel total and complete comfort on these amendments. Okay. You will live by these amendments. All right. The chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1048. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 1048 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I am supporting this bill because I think these people know the problem far better than I do and know how to solve it, but I think we really need more resources. Part of me wonders whether we're just by reorganizing things on the wiring diagram, whether we're really solving a problem. I don't know. I want to work hard this session to get more money for these programs.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. We appreciate your comments. Senator Shields.
Well, I appreciate what Senator Ringo said. I will, however, say that my experience with the Hunger Relief Task Force, and I would think what would happen here with this new one, is that they often come up with some very creative ideas and creative ways to deal with getting around our inability to do what we ought to be doing as a legislature. Yeah. And they do come up with some creative stuff that can help us address problems.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing that, so ordered. Senator Shields will carry that bill. I would ask that we're going to open a public hearing on the State Board of Chiropractic Examiners and ask Dr. McClure, Dr. Vissers, and Ms. Estelle Parker-Kent to come forward. Can we do a work session on 2829 and 2094? Right, I think. While you're sitting here, okay. All right. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves and tell us why you would like to serve on this board?
All right. I'm Dr. Joyce McClure. I've been a chiropractor for almost 18 years now. Currently serving as chairperson on the OBCE Peer Review Committee. I've been on the committee for 4 or 5 years now, I think. Excellent opportunity to sort of see what's going on in the profession at large. And I got involved in that because I felt that after so many years in practice, it was time for me to give back to the profession.
I do think I have some gifts at communication and sort of bridging the sort of divide that we have in any group. So that's why I'm here.
Great. Thank you.
Michael Vissers, chiropractor, Canby, Oregon. I've been in practice for about 15 years, and I think my interest probably was born out of a few years ago I started getting involved in some of the legislative agendas for a chiropractic profession, and I found that the legislators' perception of our profession, as well as the public, is kind of directly tied to what happens at the board as far as the public protection and our professional competency issues. And so I decided to go down to the board and just sit in on a board meeting. Ended up on the peer review committee for the last little over a year, which has really opened my eyes to the fact that, and my interest to the fact that professional competency and protecting the public are probably the two most important things that we can do for our profession. So I, too, am getting to the point in my professional career where it's time to give something back, and so that's where my interest comes from.
Great.
Hi, I'm Estelle Parker Kent. I am a correctional lieutenant for Oregon State Penitentiary. I became interested in doing something to give back to the community. At first, I wanted to work with children, but I have to be very careful with what I do as a profession and getting involved with the community and how I do it. Got on the website, started looking around, saw the Board of Chiropractic and the examination board, all these goodies in here, and thought, you know, this would be a way for me to get in, learn government, be a part of my community. So here I am.
Thank you. I will say that, you know, your job is, you are actually a part of government in what you do. So we appreciate your willingness to serve in a volunteer capacity outside of your work. So questions for these folks?
Okay.
Senator Ringo.
I have a question that I don't know if I'm going to get shot by asking this, but because I know there's some controversy. But for Dr. McClure and Dr. Vissers, you know, I'm aware of the battle of the two main professional organizations in the chiropractic profession. There's ODOC, and what's the other one?
CAO, Chiropractic Association of Oregon.
Right. Where do you guys come down on that battle?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that both of professions serve a segment of our community in terms of chiropractic. And in my opinion, a lot of times the issues come down to poor communication. People have just sort of squared off and don't like each other personally, and so then they fail to communicate about the issues. So I think it's really important to work with both sides and help them see the common ground. I do have colleagues in both associations, and I feel comfortable in terms of being able to communicate with them.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Vissers.
I've been quite impressed over the last year that the two associations have started to work together a little bit better. There's definitely some philosophical divide between the two, whether or not they can ever come together. It's probably even, you know, as easy a question as whether or not the Democrats and Republicans could ever come together. You know, they both have an idea or a philosophical base.
I have an idea.
And so I think that the whole idea is to try to find a consensus. This last year, I have sat in on a few of the legislative meetings between the two associations. They've asked me to serve on the executive board for the CAO. My feeling is as long as you're associated with a professional association, you're a benefit to the profession. And finding consensus is something that, you know, we all have to learn how to do in committees. So I think as a board, the role of the two associations is not quite as important as it is in the legislative world, because that's where our bills come to pass. But as a board, our mandate is basically regulatory. So public protection and professional competency are areas that we can really work together fairly easily.
Okay. Senator Shields.
Yeah. Estelle, I'm not wanting to leave you out, so you can jump into this question. But I want to kind of aim at our chiropractors here. Recently, in my district, I had a delightful time visiting with a clinic that aims its practice at working with the Hispanic community. And It was a wonderful education for me. I guess I'm wondering about the chiropractors in general. I know that what I learned that day was that those folks really want to get to work. get back, they have a much stronger feeling about natural medicine, naturopathic medicine, chiropractic medicine, don't want to go to the traditional doctors that we often go to and so on. What would you do, I guess, as leaders in the board, to work on this whole issue of cultural competence, cultural awareness, racial diversity awareness, and so on? Has there been much going on, and would you be interested in helping to push that kind of an initiative?
I think I don't actually know if the board has addressed. I know as far as board positions, diversity is one of the things that they'd like to see. And I know that as a board, as a profession, we would love to treat any segment of the population that needs health care. The difficulty in a lot of our offices is most of us are in private practice by ourselves. A lot of us don't speak two languages, so how do you incorporate a Spanish-speaking person or a Russian-speaking or a Vietnamese-speaking person into your office so that you can serve that clientele? I would definitely be in favor of looking into a way of how we could improve our profession's outreach into those communities.
I hope you kind of keep that in mind as you move forward, because I think it's an issue, especially as this state becomes more and more diverse, racially, ethnically.
Yeah, actually, I was at a board meeting probably 6 or 9 months ago, where that was addressed as one of the specifics for the strategic planning of the Oregon Board.
Any further questions?
I do also, just to address that briefly, I have a little background in that myself. I've had a very strong tie-in with some people in the community who do every year an intercultural communications institute. I've taken communication across healthcare cultures, across cultures, healthcare, where we deal not only with the language issues but also the cultural issues, so that communication between the Hispanic community and the Caucasian community or Asian communities is different, and their expectations of the doctor-patient relationship is different. And so in those ways, I think those are much broader issues that probably we're dealing more with Western states or at the teaching level, new doctors coming into the field, and perhaps learning by that to bring it into the field as a whole.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your willingness to come down and participate in these hearings so we can get to know you better and just get a better sense of who the governor is putting on the boards and commissions. So appreciate your time and energy and your willingness to serve the state. So we're letting these sort of sit for a week or so, and then we'll move into work session probably next week. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair would open a work session on House Bill 2029. Ms. Harris, what do we have? Do I have your bill?
You actually do.
Okay, yeah. All right.
No, we have Senator
Shields. Okay.
Today it's
we have the Dash 1 amendments. Yeah, I know.
I do have that.
Do you want to take this?
And I was looking
okay.
at it a second ago.
Okay.
To get ready. But maybe I'll take yours.
Okay.
Oh.
I don't have my bill file either.
Well, do you not want to move these bills? We heard these on Monday.
Right.
They don't look controversial to me.
I think they're not.
Well, generally what House Bill 2029 does is that it modifies requirements for reports that are submitted regularly by semi-independent state agencies to the governor, the Speaker of the House, the Senate President, and the legislative fiscal officer. The Dash 1 amendment really just adds the appraiser certification and licensure board and the state landscape architect board to the statutory list of semi-independent state agencies that would be included under the legislation.
Okay. I think that's actually a name. Is it a name change? Appraiser certification, state landscape. Okay, we're in work session. The chair would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2029. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move House Bill 2029 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry? Thank you very much for your volunteerism. And we're going to open a
Work session on House Bill 2094, the regulatory streamlining bill. Senator Shields, any comments?
No.
Okay. Would you like to make any? Senator Ringo, any comments?
No amendments to this one.
There are no amendments to House Bill 2094. I believe it passed out of the House with no votes. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I move House
One
Bill
no vote.
2094 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 2094 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so order. Senator Shields, would you please carry that one?
I guess so.
All right. And then last but not least, we have David Williams, to testify on the Workforce Investment Board. Why don't you come on up? And we have three people to testify by phone. I need to actually leave for a meeting. Mr. Williams, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and why you would like to serve on the Workforce Investment Board.
Okay, Madam Chair and Senator Shields and Senator Ringo. I am Dave Williams. I work for Northwest Natural Gas Company. Mm-hmm. I've worked for them for about 28 years this July.
Wow.
And so I've been in the utility industry for a long time. I think I could sum up in just one sentence why I want to participate on this board, and that would be to have an opportunity to help develop and work on the governor's strategic initiatives for the workforce in the state of Oregon.
Wow.
Short and sweet.
Thank you. Questions? What do you do for Northwest Natural?
My job there is director of utility operations and labor relations for them.
And what do you see as critical for the state legislature to do in terms of what do you think we should be doing in terms of working towards workforce investment, economic development?
Yeah, I think it's an important question, Madam Chair, for all of the business community to think about how we're going to recruit, retain employees in our businesses. It's one of the main issues for us is getting competent, skilled employees into our companies to help us be successful. So how we do that, how those employees, potential candidates or employees are trained and brought forth to ultimately come as entry-level positions, as well as understanding the demographic changes in the workforce, and then understanding as a company how we bring those individuals into mid-career hires as well.
Are most of your new hires at Northwest Natural, are they graduate, undergraduate, high school level graduate? What kind of education level?
Madam Chair, we hire approximately 100 employees into Northwest Natural every year. Most of those employees are hired in entry level jobs. Believe it or not, these are meter readers, call center employees, and construction employees.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our employees that are in the meter reader and call center employees are usually educated with some college and some degrees. Those that enter in the construction side, however, are typically our non-degreed employees. Our mid-career hire employees are typically always degreed employees.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Shields, go ahead.
I have been thinking since the earlier discussions around poverty and homelessness and hunger and so on about the connection between the two. You know, workforce development, that sounds, a lot of us don't stop and think about it a lot. You know, it's getting people jobs and getting them to work and so on. Do you do much reflection on the issue of poverty in our state and homelessness and how that kind of relates to what you'll be doing in the workforce development?
Senator, it's an interesting connection. There's two ways in which I look at that. One is on a social and moral ground, which I participate and have been a chair of the Metro the Metro Salvation Army, which I was also participating in a greenhouse arm, which many of you probably are familiar with. So I have a personal interest in homeless, especially homeless youth, and how they ultimately develop, get jobs, enter into society as contributing members. The other side, of course, is how we recruit our own employees and where do we go for outreach into the communities that we serve to bring employees in. Unfortunately, that part of that process screens out many of the employee or many of the potential employees that are in those situations, because many of them do not have valid driver's license, cannot pass the drug screens, and those kinds of things. So there is an issue in bringing those people off the street and into permanent employment.
And at least it's good to have somebody sensitized to that wide range of dynamics. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions?
Well, I just want to thank you for your willingness to serve on the board.
Yes, thank you very much. Appreciate your time and energy.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on the Workforce Investment Board. Mr. Williams, just for your information, we'll probably move these appointments forward next week. Senator Shields, are you leaving me?
No.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on the nursing home examiners. I'm going to have committee staff dial up our witnesses, and I'm going to head out for my meeting and let these guys take over. I know Senator Ringo has to move as well. So. All right. Great. Thank you. Sure. 8-9.
Hello?
Yes, is this Margaret Clark?
Yes, it is.
Margaret, I'm State Senator Frank Shields. There's a couple of us senators here, myself and Senator Charlie Ringo. We're doing a kind of a subcommittee hearing on nominations to boards. Your appointment to the Nursing Home Examiners Board is what we wanted to talk to you about for a few minutes.
Senator.
Could you just tell us a little bit about your background and a little bit about yourself briefly?
Well, I am I'm a registered nurse. I trained in England. I've been in this country for 46 years. I worked in home care, and I dealt very much with Kaiser Expanded Care, which has a wonderful method of giving respite by allowing people to go into a nursing home for a couple of weeks and let the family have a rest. And so I was in and out of a lot of nursing homes when I was doing that, and I became the ombudsman at the Robeson home for 2 years. I've always been very interested in the nursing homes and in improving the nursing homes, and I was approached to go on the board as the nurse representative, which I did, but then I retired, and because I was not putting up enough hours to maintain my license, I was no longer able to stay on the board. So I applied for the position of public member, and that is the position that I've been asking to do now.
Okay. So how many years of experience did you already have on this board?
I was only on the board for a year.
Uh-huh.
I didn't really think about the fact that if I retired, I wouldn't have my license and I would no longer be eligible, or I would not have taken it in the first place because it caused a difficulty for them.
Well, it sounds like you'll be more than able to make up for that with this public member role.
Well, I have had a lot of experience in many things, and I do a lot of things with seniors and with Alzheimer's, and I'm very active as a volunteer. This is only one of the things that I do.
As a person who was a member of the clergy for 30 some years, I've walked into lots and lots of nursing homes to see parishioners.
Yes.
And I became my own kind of a nursing home examiner, you might say, because I saw such a diversity in nursing homes.
Yes.
What are some of the areas that you would spend your time in as you look to improve what's offered out there?
Well, one of the things about the nursing home administrators is that I feel that they absolutely have to have a grasp of what the CNAs do. The CNAs are very poorly paid, They do a wonderful job. It is a job that is never ends. That you feed people and you change people and you make beds and you go back the next day and you do the same thing. And it's a very courageous job that they do. And I'm very concerned that the nursing home administrators are concerned about their staff. And also, as the ombudsman, I feel that they, it's a wonderful resource for the nursing home administrators, and they should use it. But I feel, Senator, that the nursing homes are vastly improved. You went in and out for 30 years, and I'm sure that you found that they have changed enormously. They're vastly upgraded.
Yeah, you're right. Some years ago, I sponsored an elder abuse bill.
Yes, I remember it.
What do you think about that? Is that something you'll be keeping an eye on as well? It's an issue that some of those CNAs and so on are very, very fine, really, really good people, and the nursing home industry couldn't exist without them. But once in a while, you get an issue of abuse.
Having worked in home care, Senator, you get an issue of abuse from families, too. But, you know, I grew up in England, and I was trained in a hospital where we had open wards. And I'm a devotee of open wards. I feel that the patient in a closed room is vulnerable, whereas a patient in an open space with lots of other people around is much less vulnerable. And so the open door policy is something that I am very careful about. I do not like to go into a nursing home and see closed doors because it makes me suspicious.
Closed doors can mean isolation, and that can mean danger sometimes.
That's right. It makes people vulnerable to anybody who is preys on them, and they go in and close the door. So that's one of the things that I watch out for.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us. Is there anything else you'd like to share this afternoon?
Well, I feel very privileged to be on this board of nursing home examiners. And I'm very grateful to you for letting me come in as a public member when I flubbed as an RN.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I hope I'll meet you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Now, what do we do? I'm not going to mess with technology, even a telephone. You can handle it.
If you're leaving that to me, you've got a lot of things to worry about.
Enterprise. Oh, here we go. It must be Larry Davy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so
this is Larry Davy.
Yes, Larry. This is State Senator Frank Shields. I'm doing a little work this afternoon in a subcommittee of the Rules Committee of the State Senate, and we just wanted to talk to you for a few minutes about your nursing home examiner's application. You're a nursing home administrator yourself. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been in the industry and so on.
Okay. Yes, Senator. Background as far as being in the industry was trained as a registered nurse in the early 80s and spent many years working through various positions such as certified nurse's assistant, registered nurse, and then various levels of nursing management. And I'm currently CEO and administrator of hospital and nursing home together. And so I've been in very many facets of healthcare, both acute care and long-term care. My training, again, registered nurse, and then also the nursing home administrator process, and have a master's in business administration with a healthcare emphasis, and then, I guess lastly, I'm certified by the American College of Healthcare Executives as a healthcare executive.
Great. How big a nursing home is this out there in Eastern Oregon that you've got?
We have in one building a 32-bed nursing home and a 25-bed hospital.
Okay. What are some of the key issues you might see coming in front of the nursing home examiners in the next few years when you'll be there on the board?
Well, you know, from following minutes of the board in the recent past and also the industry itself, I think a key issue that all of us come from is maintaining high-quality medical care with the rapidly expanding senior population. And I think the Board of Examiners is in a key position as to overseeing the identification, training of potential nursing home administrators, and also the oversight and educational development of administrators, which I believe is a very key position in moving senior care forward in the future with its challenges. So I think those kind of oversee the types of issues that do come to the board.
I asked this of another person that the Senate will be considering as well. There's three openings, as you know. I was a clergy person for 30 years and went into a lot of different nursing homes, saw nursing home issues from the perspective of kind of looking at it through the eyes of my parishioners. Lots of issues bubble up over the years, everything from abuse issues to the maintenance issues of a nursing home to just all kinds of issues, safety issues, so on and so forth. Would you like to just comment briefly on how you deal with that kind of multiplicity of issues that can bubble to the surface, the unexpected ones especially?
Sure. Long-term care is an extremely difficult arena to manage and provide care because of a number of issues. One big one is obviously the financial challenges that we confront and how to maintain high quality within those dramatic limitations. Does take a lot of creativity, and my belief is you cannot sacrifice quality no matter what, even if you have financial issues, and we do creative things to get around that through donations and community support, and have managed to have a very high quality facility, and you articulated very well myriad of challenges that we have with keeping good staff, developing them, meeting very high standards. At least from our perspective, it is a matter of grooming good people, talented people, and as a group, working together to meet those needs. And again, I don't want to minimize that it's easy, but it is doable with a good team.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your response. What we're doing here in the Senate, in the Rules Committee, is we're going to cogitate on these, let them ruminate for about a week, and then we'll have a work session. Today was just the hearing part of it.
Okay.
And so I'll carry my impressions to the rest of the committee, and we'll be probably talking with you after next week's work session.
Okay.
Okay?
Very much appreciate your call.
Thank you very much, Larry. Appreciate it.
Bye.
I'll try this. Now, what you do is push this. And what's her background?
Is
afternoon, Aiden Healthcare. This is Deb.
Is Kathleen Elias around there?
Yes, may I ask who's calling?
This is State Senator Frank Shields calling from the Senate Rules Committee.
Yes, hold on, please. Hi, this is Kathy. May I help you?
Yes, Kathy. This is State Senator Frank Shields. I'm doing a little bit of subcommittee work for the Rules Committee of the Senate.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Just wanted a chance to talk to you a little bit about your nomination to the Nursing Home Examiners Board. Wanted you to give us a little bit of your background and why you're interested in being on the board.
Basically, the reason I want to be on the board is because I'm an RN, and I'm an RN administrator, and I think that we can be proactive within the state and deliver long-term care to our dependent seniors. And I think if we're creative, I can assure that these people are well cared for. And I'm very tired. I apologize. I've been up since 2 this morning.
End of a long shift, huh?
Yes, it has been. And I've been a nurse for 29 years, almost 30 now. And my variety of background, our seniors are very complex, they're dependent, and they're a challenge and keep me interested in learning daily.
Well, I appreciate your answer. I'm thinking about all the issues that I've talked to a couple other people that are potentially going on the board, and you just mentioned something I hadn't thought about. What kind of problems are you going to be looking at on this board as you see an ever increasing population of seniors in nursing homes and alternatives to nursing homes, as Oregon is moving that way faster than most states?
Yes, we are, and I think that's a plus for us. Our problems that I see forthcoming would be adequate staffing, adequate training of our nurses in the future, adequate training of our administrators in understanding the importance of the nurse and the nursing component within care of our seniors, and the ability to keep them healthy. Other problems I see is being able to work cooperatively with our survey process within the state of Oregon and the federal government. But I think Oregon is well ahead. They have started a committee themselves between providers and the state survey team so that they can be a cooperative learning environment as long-term care, both with a nursing home and assisted living, can work cooperatively together to bring a better product to our seniors.
How do you feel about all of the options in the continuum that I, as a minister, have seen that are offered to seniors, whether it goes from foster care to nursing home, residential, whatever?
I think the options are important. Nursing homes are the last stop for many people. The goal has always been, if someone doesn't need to live in a nursing home, can we get them to a lesser level of care that is appropriate for them, be it foster care, assisted living, residential care?
Well, that's a wonderful answer, and I appreciate it. I remember several years ago that Multnomah County itself had more foster care options for seniors than the whole state of Florida. And when, in fact, the first stop is a nursing home, that's a bad thing. It should be the last in the continuum of options available.
I agree totally with that. It's the last stop. But also, I've seen the trend since my background is acute care originally, trauma unit nursing and operating room nursing. I see a need for the skilled population within the nursing home to be able to rehab and go home or to another level of care. I'm seeing nursing homes become the hospital of the past, and that's now we need to make sure that our nursing homes are up to snuff and can deliver that care to those residents.
You're absolutely right. 20 years ago, I seldom, if ever, saw anybody go into a nursing home for rehab and then come out and go back home, and yet that happened with my own father. in the last few years. So I understand that's a new dynamic.
Yes, and it's still, and we need to have our staff skilled to be able to handle all the issues that come up.
It sounds like you'll be an excellent addition. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Just keep up the good work. I want you to know that I'll be sharing with the committee my reactions to these interviews, and we'll be ruminating on this and probably go into a work session of the Rules Committee next week sometime, and the official votes in the Senate will follow that very shortly.
Okay.
Okay.
So should I stay here and wait for another call today, or
no? There'll be no more phone calls. This interview is the only one that's needed.
Okay.
The governor's office will be getting in touch with you. I'm just very impressed with this conversation we've had, and I'll be sharing that with the Rules Committee and the Senate itself.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, well, thank you for being willing to do that good work that you've obviously been doing over the years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And with that, we can adjourn the Rules Committee. Thank you.
Thank you.